This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Storms ripped through the South with at least 8 confirmed tornadoes touching down in Alabama and Georgia. CBS's Mark Strassman.
Recovery from several tornadoes that tore across Alabama and Georgia today.
Look at the stuff flying.
A severe weather outbreak pummeling states from north to south. In Abbeville, Alabama, a reported large tornado cut through, damaging a few buildings, while nearby Eufaula fared worse, a twister downing trees and power lines.
More rough weather is expected overnight. The Federal Reserve decides to leave interest rates unchanged after 15 months of increases. CBS's Sarah Ewald Weiss has more from Washington.
The Federal Reserve paused interest rate hikes for June, but we could see 2 more interest rate hikes this year. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said they will make the decisions based on incoming data, but they're not expected to cut rates anytime soon.
Attorney General Merrick Garland is standing behind Special Counsel Jack Smith and his team's investigation into the classified documents case, which has yielded a 37-count indictment against former President Trump.
It underscores the Justice Department's commitment to both independence and accountability.
Trump has pleaded not guilty. High concentrations of phosphorus are an essential element for life on Earth, and now they've been detected in ice crystals on Saturn's moon, Enceladus. CBS News space consultant Bill Harwood.
The finding that really adds strength to the case that Enceladus has a possibly habitable environment under its frozen crust. You know, they think there's an ocean under the surface of Enceladus that may possibly be an abode for life. Of course, just because the ingredients are there doesn't mean life is there.
The findings were published in the journal Nature and announced by NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. Russian forces hit southern and eastern Ukraine with missiles overnight, killing at least 6 people. The attacks come as Ukrainian forces continue to take back land seized by the Russians. CBS's Ian Lee reports.
Darkness is an ally for Ukrainian troops. Night vision gives this territorial defense brigade an advantage as they silently get into position. When day breaks, they attack. This soldier, callsign Blacksmith, stormed the Russian positions. Their defenses are strong, he tells me. The Russians had time to dig in. They defended fiercely, but lately they started running away.
The Australian government expects to soon introduce legislation to prevent Russia from building a new embassy near Parliament House on security grounds. The Oakland Athletics move to Vegas clears a major hurdle with Nevada's legislature's final approval of public stadium funding. This is CBS News.
Need hires who dazzle without the hassle? You need Indeed. Their powerful platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
News is brought to you by Gingras Thompson & Wachs, a statewide team of personal injury lawyers getting you the justice you deserve. Call 855-954-1186 for a free consultation.
Here's what you need to know in western Wisconsin. Good afternoon, I'm Jimmy Kuska. It's the third day of searching for a missing boy in Sauk County. 13-year-old James Yablonski has been missing since Monday morning. The Sauk County Sheriff's Office said that the boy took his family's van, which was found along Highway 12 near the Baraboo Bluffs, or about 2 miles from Devil's Lake State Park. Officials said that a handgun was also missing from the family's home. The DNR and multiple law enforcement agencies are searching the woods on the ground and in the air, but said that the terrain has made the search challenging. Anyone with information is asked to call the Sauk County Sheriff's Office. An air quality advisory has been issued for all of northwestern and central Wisconsin through noon tomorrow. Wildfire smoke from Canada is pushing down into the upper Midwest, with current air quality unhealthy for children and people with certain medical conditions. And the state high school baseball championships continue this afternoon. Earlier today, St. Croix Falls and Aquinas both won 10-0 in 6 innings to advance. They'll face each other in tomorrow's Division III State Baseball Championship game. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Kuska.
More than 130,000 car accidents occur in Wisconsin each year. If you're in an accident and experience any injuries or losses caused by another, you may be entitled to compensation. Gingras Thompson & Wachs has over 35 years of experience in handling car accident cases. Their team of personal injury attorneys is dedicated to helping you get the justice you deserve.
All in to win, Gingras Thompson & Wachs, GTW Lawyers.com.
It's June Dairy Month.
And though more than 5 million people call Wisconsin home, we share our estate with close to 1.5 million cows. Those beautiful animals. Yes, okay, I grew up on a dairy farm outside of Green Bay. They've been here since before we became a state. Can you answer this? Most of our cow's milk currently makes which product? Is it butter, cheese, or ice cream? The answer coming up. Wisconsin's first official milk plant, 1894 in the Waupun area of Fond du Lac County. Fast forward more than 120 years, now farmer-owned with a second location in the Outagamie County village of Black Creek, the Saputo plant is even featured on History Channel's Modern Marvels for its award-winning cheesemaking. So did you guess? Most of our cow's milk, 90% of it currently makes cheese. Gouda for you. Join us in thanking our farmers by celebrating June Dairy Month. For the Civic Media Network, I'm Terry Barr.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Ventures.
This is 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
Welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, the Senate did something today. Oh, no, it was actually yesterday. I get my days mixed up. I got this COVID brain fog. I think that's what it is. But evidently, the Senate did their job. They confirmed someone, Biden's chief economist, Jared Bernstein, who's been on this program over the years a number of times. He has now been confirmed. I guess that he's now going to start doing the job of continuing to make our economy better. And I like Jared Bernstein. I think he's a bright guy. I think he's a good guy. I think he's the right guy for the job. And thank goodness Tommy Tuberville, the dumbest guy in the Senate, didn't show up, which made the vote that much easier. So at least you did something positive. Dumb guy. My thoughts. I don't want you to come along with me. But here's the thing, and this is what gets me. I look at our Republican friends and all of the division, all of the nonsense. You know, they're going to sue Schiff? Really? Going to go $16 billion. And yet they're moving economic policies that are going to be horribly destructive for the working class. In fact, my favorite, we talked about this yesterday, the Tax Cuts for Working Families Act. And what does it do? Well, it makes rich people richer and you and me poorer. And here to share some thoughts on these handful of bills that our Republican friends have thrown forward. I've asked our good friend Amy Anauer to come talk with us. Amy is the executive director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, ITEP.org, the website. Amy, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, great to talk to you, Rick.
So let's get to these economic bills that our Republican friends are going to be moving forward. This Tax Cuts for Working Families Act. Bottom line, working families in this country, what can we expect if this becomes law? How much can I put in my pocket? How many movies can I take my wife to? How many, you know, ball games can I take my kids to? How much am I getting from my GOP friends in this Tax Cuts for Working Families Act?
Yeah, well, it's the most misnamed thing you ever heard of, because this thing gives more than $16,000 to people in the top 1%, while regular working class families get about $340. That's what the people in the middle get. The poorest fifth get just $40. So, like, poor people in this country are going to get enough barely to fill one tank of gas. If you're middle income, you're going to get enough to maybe buy four tires. Actually, not even.
What tires are you buying?
Yeah, well, I found some online that were that cheap. And then, you know, if you're wealthy, more than $16,000, you could buy an economy priced car. Of course, the top 1%ers aren't buying an economy priced car. But even more than that, Rick, I think the point is, you know, it's the $340, you know, and your kid's tuition goes up, right? The price to take care of your older parents goes up. Your child care, you got no chance that anybody in government's going to help you pay for it. So it's, you know, what it does is it defunds our ability to kind of deliver for working class families the things they need, the things that create jobs, the things that keep our infrastructure strong, and the things that help us take care of our families.
And you know, the thing that gets me, and this is, now look, maybe you'll agree with me, maybe you won't. But this piece of legislation doesn't stand a snowball's chance in hell of passing. There's no way this becomes law in this day and age. I don't think it even gets out of the Senate. And if it does by some miracle that they find, they do this, anything, Biden's going to veto this. So as a messaging vehicle, I look at this and going, this is supposedly, and I've said this a couple of times, the Tax Cuts for Working Families Act. And you're only in a performative messaging bill giving working families between $40 and $340 bucks? Really?
Right. Well, they're giving $61 billion to the richest fifth of Americans. So it's just, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And, you know, we just, as you might remember, it's been like 2, maybe 3 weeks, we had this huge showdown that, you know, the world was going to end if we didn't bring the deficit down, if we didn't bring the debt down. And this is going to add incredibly to the debt. So I don't understand it either. I don't think it's a great messaging vehicle. I think it's bad for America and it's bad for inequality. And it just continues to kind of drive us further apart and make this country function less well.
But Amy, this whole tax cut fetish is bad for America. This whole addiction to tax cuts for the very wealthy is bad for America. And look, we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs to every time we hear, you know, taxes, to foam at the mouth without asking who we're taxing, why we're taxing, what we're going to use it for. And those line of questioning, we've just trained taxes, foam at the mouth. And yet time and time again, we working people get screwed over and over. And even in, like, I kind of got, and maybe I'll ask this as a question. Am I making too much of a deal out of this, that this is a messaging bill? This is a messaging bill showing us what Republican priorities are, and they've called it the Tax Cuts for Working Families Act, and working families get barely enough, as you pointed out, to get a tank of gas, and certainly not enough to get tires on the car. Maybe one, maybe one and a half tires. But you know, I'm curious who these working people are that the Republicans are messaging to.
Right. Well, and you didn't even get to the foreign investors, right? They would get $23.8 billion.
Oh, I was getting there.
So, you know, I mean, I think that there's just an assumption that we're just not that smart, that we can't do addition, that we can't sort of figure it out. Or like you say, that we just foam at the mouth. But the fact is, tax cuts for the uber rich and tax cuts for corporations are not popular. You know, I think working people and middle class people and just regular people across the board recognize that if you're earning billions of dollars in this country, you should pay into the country that made you rich. You should support the roads that enable you to get your products out. You should support the schools that enable you to hire workers. And so, you know, a lot of what's in this bill is corporate tax cuts that are huge giveaways to a lot of corporations that don't pay their fair share already.
A big giant welfare check we give to our wealthy while demeaning people who need a helping hand at the bottom. People like my mother who needed food stamps when I was a kid. And, you know, like, I'm not ashamed of it. The reality is we needed that help and we got that help, and our country gave me that opportunity to pay the kind of taxes that I pay. And I'm happy to do it because I want to make sure that kid growing up like I did has the same shot. And this is where these are conversations we don't have anymore. It's all about how do we make billionaires possible, when the reality is the vast majority of us aren't even going to ever meet a billionaire, let alone be one.
Right. Yeah. And look, we're pricing a lot of things just completely out of reach of working families. You know, a college education, it used to be that you could work a minimum wage job in the summer and pay for a year of school at a state school. You know, no more, because so many states have just cut their taxes. Again, usually targeting those tax cuts to the very wealthy and to corporations, that tuition at a state school is no longer within reach from a minimum wage job. Well, partly because the minimum wage has gone down so much, But so we really need to kind of
and to highlight
step back
that.
And say, what do we want? You know?
Yeah, to highlight that, you know, here in Pennsylvania where I live, the president of APSCoF, the faculty union for the state system of higher education, he told me that back in the 80s, the state and local tax base picked up about 2/3 of the cost of an education. Student picked up about 1/3. Today, that number is completely flipped upside down to where the state and local tax base picking up maybe 25% and the student is picking up 75%.
That's right. And then what happens is kids get out of school, right? They've got this debt that's saddling them down. They can't possibly buy a house because, you know, the housing prices have gone up so much and because they've got so much student debt. So, you know, that's for kids who are lucky enough to be able to get a four-year degree. For people who are unable to get that four-year degree, they're facing a job market that doesn't value them. So I think we really need to sort of step back and reset and say, you know, if you're going to call something, what did you say it's called again? The Tax Cuts for Working Families Act. You know, it should do something for working families, and it shouldn't be something that's, you know, ubercharging our inequality, making the 1% wealthier, enabling corporations to get away with not paying anything. It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, it's like when John Roberts says he's going to call balls and strikes, probably should have asked what game he was talking about. Same thing. You know, this is for working families. I kind of need to know what your definition of working families are, because I don't think Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk's family, I don't know that those are working families.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, like one of the tax breaks in this thing, bonus depreciation, it's something that helped dozens of Americans' hugest corporations avoid $50 billion in taxes over the last several years. And I'm talking about like Verizon, FedEx, Walt Disney, General Motors, Amazon. You know, these are huge companies that make billions from the American people. And we need them to pay into the system that got them rich.
And this is where I'm a big fan of a much higher corporate tax rate. And help me here, because I believe that, you know, you go back to the golden age of the economy, the 50s and 60s, when unionization rates were really high, where the CEO was making 20, 30 times that of the average worker. But tax rates, corporate tax rates, were in the 50% range. The top marginal tax rate was in the 90% range. I argue that when you had those higher tax rates, workers got higher wages because, look, you know, rich people, they don't want to give the government money. So they gave it out in higher wages. They gave it out in, you know, investments in the local community, hospital wings, schools, all kinds of stuff. But the money was being used in the community, and I would argue efficiently. But by giving our billionaire class just, well, unimaginable wealth that most of us can't even fathom, and being able to hoard it and have overweighted influence, we've really caused ourselves a major crisis.
No, I think that's right. I mean, we when tax rates were higher, and particularly when companies actually paid the rates that they were at, right? Because that's the bigger problem than the rates, is that companies don't even pay the rates that we have because of these tax breaks. And, you know, one of the other business tax breaks that this legislation, the Republicans just passed out of committee, want, would make it easier for private equity firms to buy businesses. Like, we need more private equity in our economy. What drove Toys R Us and Payless into bankruptcy? What, you know, tried to take away pensions from workers in those industries? Like, that's the last thing we need, right?
Yeah. No, we should be there should be legislation to break up these behemoths, not encourage more of them. I do want to go back to the foreign investors making a boatload of money. How is it that our politicians that we vote for seem to have more concern for foreign investors and for foreign corporations than they have for American workers? I say all the time, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. This is another one of those things that shows me that Republicans hate working people. But again, this is a messaging bill. Why would you put this out there? Or who are you messaging to, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to ask whether people are messaging to their donors or whether they're messaging to the citizens of this country. And, you know, that's the question we got to ask, right? We have far too much money in politics that just does a lot to pull the strings. And, one of the kind of givens is that if the Republicans take over the House or the Senate, they're gonna put through tax cuts for wealthy people and corporations. It's something that seems to always happen. But I agree with you. I don't think it messages well. I don't think the American people are buying it. And one of the things that's kind of encouraging, Rick, is that I think the next generation is really really not having it, right? Like, I think a lot of young people are just pissed off. As I was mentioning before, you know, they've got student debt. They don't find themselves able to buy a house. They're struggling to find a job where they can get a union contract. They're struggling to make decent wages. And so, you know, I think just as we're seeing more attempts to organize unions in workplaces, I think we're seeing more of a sentiment from young people that they'd like to see rich people and corporations taxed, and they'd like to use that revenue to make our economy kind of work for all of us.
Yep. No, I have some hope. I do. I'm not all doom and gloom all the time. But Amy, I appreciate the thoughts. I hope folks will check out your report on this. The trio of GOP tax bills would expand corporate tax breaks while doing little for Americans who need it most. You can see this over at ITEP.org, ITEP.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Amy Hanauer, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Always love talking to you, Rick. Thanks so much. Take care.
Our good friend Amy Hanauer, executive director there at the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy, ITEP.org, the website. Quick break, right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Now, I got to tell you, it's amazing to me. It really is that this is a messaging bill. This is a messaging bill saying, hey, working people, look how much we care about you. $40. You'll get $40. For you solidly in the middle class, you'll get $340. And look, $340 is, you know, I'm not saying it's nothing. But is that worth throwing everything else away? Shocking, to be honest. Quite shocking when you think about it. It's a messaging bill. I love the Wall Street Journal article today that pointed out that Republicans are now becoming less dependent on corporate America. And I'm going, really? They're saying smaller donors are making up the Republican Party's allies. And I'm going, really? I still think there's some corporate cash being flown underneath. But, you know, hey, the Budweiser thing probably scaring a lot of corporations away. A lot of the craziness that the GOP's putting themselves in probably scaring people, I don't know, just a little bit. You think? But we're in this moment where things are changing. And this is where I make this plea to working people. Look at these bills that they put forth. And look at the I say this about every budget, about every economic vehicle that they use. Look at what their priorities are. Look at who they're taking from. Look at who they're giving to. This goes back to me to eighth grade government class. I still remember Mr. DeSillo at the front of the class going, "At the reality is government decides who gets what. If you don't participate, if you don't vote, good. Makes my vote stronger. I get what I want." And it was, for me, that was one of those crystal moments that government decides who gets what. Do I like it? No. But the reality is I would prefer it that way to Elon Musk deciding who gets what, to Jeff Bezos, to a handful of billionaires, a handful of oligarchs. And this is where I get into trouble with a lot of my conservative friends, because they're, "Well, I don't believe in government. Government's bad." Well, then you believe people are bad. Bad people make bad government. And when Republicans are in charge, they show us just how badly they can run government. That is absolutely true. There is no arguing with you on that. I am 100% behind my conservative friends who say government doesn't work as long as you add the amendment that Republican-led government doesn't work. Republicans hate working people. What do we get? Now, a system of representatives fighting for we the people, actually wanting to do their job, actually wanting to make people's lives better, actually wanting... And I know I talk about this a lot because I think about it a lot. I think about the kid growing up in that housing project that I grew up in. Now, I'm miles economically and geographically away from that beginning. I've been very fortunate. I've worked hard. I've played by the rules. I've done pretty well for myself. I want that for that kid growing up in the place that I grew up in. I want that kid to have every opportunity and more. And I fear that the pathways that were available to me are not going to be available to them. So I think about that person a lot. How to make that person's life better. Not how we take food off of their table, not how we kick them out of low-cost housing, not how we make them pull themselves up by bootstraps they don't have. It's quite remarkable to me. And yet, you know, we're in this moment. We're in this moment where the Republican Party has shown us who they are. They're void of real ideas that are going to help working people. And Democrats, there's an opportunity here. There's an opportunity for Democrats to stop all of the extreme stuff. For instance, Illinois. You got all these red states across the country. All these red states across the country were banning books. You got all Alabama, Mississippi, they're all banning books. We've got to get books out of the school, got to ban them. So what does Illinois do? They pass a ban on banning books. And I'm going, no, that's not the response to this. The response is to go after those places that are doing this, educate a little bit, but not go extremely the other way. Because look, there are some books, perhaps, that shouldn't be in the hands of children. So to then go way to the other extreme, I'm not on board with either. And that's where I think the mass of the American people are. We don't want polar opposites fighting each other all the time. I understand there are ideological differences. Joe Walsh and I are friendly. Joe Walsh and I have had spirited conversations. But we're on the same page on defending democracy. We're on the same page on a number of issues. But ideologically, on a lot of things, we're in different worlds and we'll fight. But here's the thing. I believe that the two of us sat down over a beer, we could come up with solutions to make lives better. That's what I want from our government again. This idea that, well, if you do something, I've got to do this. And we end up in these weird spaces. What I want them to do the job that we send them there to do. I would like a political system, if we could get it, and this is where engaged, active, educated voters looking at messaging vehicles like this working families tax act have to hold elected people accountable. And here's the thing, by them doing this and all of the craziness we're seeing coming out of Marjorie Three Names and Lauren Boebert and the rest of them, they know. They don't care about you or me. They're not afraid of we the voters because they think we're going to keep buying red hat, blue hat. And at some point, I'm hoping, it's always my greatest hope, The greatest email I get from people, and if you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, I do answer the angry and the evil and the hateful first. In fact, the people who wished me quite ill and demise, not this time, sorry. It looks like I'm going to pull through. But here's the thing. The one thing that I love when someone emails me, they say, look, I don't like you. I think you're an idiot. I disagree with you on everything. But this one thing made me think. This made me think just a little bit differently. This made me, I didn't know that. That, to me, is the best email I could get. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1921. During that summer, the battle waged over the efforts to unionize the southwestern West Virginia coal mines. The miners had been evicted from their company homes and had established tent colonies. One was located at Lick Creek. On this fateful day, state police and company gun thugs raided the Lick Creek camp. The police claimed that members of the tent colony had been shooting at strikebreakers. They arrested 56 men and destroyed the tents and furniture in the camp. One striker was shot down and killed. Later that summer, at their convention in Matewan, West Virginia, the delegates of the United Mine Workers of America adopted a resolution condemning the action. The attack on the tent colony was included in a list of grievances against the mine owners. It described the attack as one of the most brutal murders ever committed in the history of our state by the state police and deputies. Composed of the Baldwin Felts detectives was the attack on the Lick Creek tent colony on June 14, 1921, in which our brother, Alex Breadlove, willfully murdered by the state police while his hands were uplifted and begging for God to have mercy on his soul. The resolution went on to condemn the atrocities against the miners and demand the federal government and governor of West Virginia to restore law to the local police forces. The resolution was sent to the President of the United States, West Virginia's Governor Morgan, and the officials of the American Federation of Labor. It was also sent to Labor and other newspapers. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
As Scottish literary giant Robert Burns wrote, the best-laid schemes of mice and men go oft awry. His 1785 poem, titled To a Mouse, could be directed today at the right-wing sloganeers who've been scheming so furiously to turn their hokey woke snobbery into a winning political stratagem. Your local librarian is woke, they screech. So is Disney Inc., some of your churches too, plus all Democrats and, oh my God, even Bud Light. Creeping wokeism is the new Red Scare, Welfare Queen and Willie Horton political bugaboos rolled into one, forming the main, quote, issue of Republicans now running for president, Congress, and dog catcher. But rather than getting defensive, insisting you are not woke, consider firing back by saying, of course I'm woke. For the great majority of Americans, being woke is a very positive characteristic, meaning you're awake, attentive to what's going on. Indeed, in black communities, stay woke has long meant staying alert to racial and social injustices. But even some Republicans must consider it bizarrely self-defeating for their party's top candidates to be urging voters to go to sleep. GOP leaders explain that anti-woke means crusading against DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusiveness. But wait, that means they're opposing America itself. For we are a nation united under the essential principle of e pluribus unum. As affirmed by everything from the Declaration of Independence to our kindergarten teachings of sharing and fairness, ours is a country rooted in constant diversification, expanding equality, and the democratic idea that every voice ought to be included. Our country needs more of all three. This is Jim Hightower saying America is way short of achieving these historic ideals, but shame on those demanding we abandon even striving for them. Confront the charlatans.
Well,
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I've been waiting all day to talk to my next guest. She's written the book. It's called Data-Driven Truckers Technology and New Workplace Surveillance. And look, this book, I've had a front row to. She's taking a look at the trucking industry and all of the things that have happened over the last 30, 40 years to use truck drivers. The analogy they use, the canary in the coal mine, that's one of them things. But I like to use them as guinea pigs. All of the things they want to do to the rest of society, they start with truck drivers, especially long-haul folks who aren't as organized and aren't as able to push back. You know, the CDL stuff, a national driver's license, and now with all this electronic data and all of this collection and all of this Big Brother watching, there's a lot going on here. And that's why I've asked Karen Levy to come talk with us. Karen's an associate professor in the Department of Information Science at Cornell University, also an associate member of the faculty at Cornell's Law School, also field faculty in sociology, science and technology studies, media studies, data science, and of course the author of Data Driven. Karen Levy, thanks for taking time for us.
It's so nice to be with you. Thanks for having me.
What a resume you've got there. Almost couldn't get it out, but hey, great book. Let me start with the first question. Why someone with your academic credentials, why worrying about truck drivers?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I didn't know any truck drivers before I started working on this project. I've been working on it for about 12 years now. So, you know, my background is in sociology and in law. And I was really interested in how, you know, in lots of different areas of life, we use digital technologies to enforce rules in different ways, right? Maybe things that we depended on trust before, or we depended on human beings to decide how they were going to enforce rules, you know, in lots of different contexts, healthcare and education all over the place, we turn to computers to do that, right? And often to surveillance technology. So I was looking for a place where I could really study that and study how it was affecting folks. And I was really interested in doing something about work and labor, because that's where we see a lot of this kind of rule enforcement happening. So it was kind of a fluke, to be honest with you. I ended up listening to a story on the radio about the fact that truckers were going to be digitally monitored. Their time, which is federally regulated, was going to be monitored via these digital devices called electronic logging devices. This was back in 2011. So I heard that story on the radio and I thought, like, that's kind of what I'm looking for. So that day I went to a truck stop just outside Portland, Oregon, which is where I was living at the time, just to see what it was like to talk to truckers. And it turns out it was great. Like, I had a great time talking to truckers. They were super open and generous with me, told me a lot about their work and their lives. And it became really clear that there was a story that more people should hear about what the life of, you know, being a trucker was like and how technology was changing their work.
Well, what they wanted to do back then to truck drivers eventually is I would argue already in the workplace today. A lot of us just don't know it, but it's this constant surveillance and this constant technology is going to be our future and their savior. And there's two schools of thought in this, and you write about this in the book. You know, there's this, oh, it's going to be fabulous. We're all going to, you know, have these wonderful lives. It's kind of what they did with deindustrialization back in the 80s. Get rid of those dirty factory jobs and we'll all breathe clean air and have white collar jobs with corner offices. But here again, you know, what happens, the working class end up taking it on the chin, or it's the dystopian thing like I've said. We're going to all be looking for jobs because there's going to be no work available. So can you talk a little bit to the juxtaposition of those two polar opposite points?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's exactly right. People tend to be either incredibly enthusiastic and excited about the prospect of new technology, or they're really doom and gloom dystopian. And I think the answer, not surprisingly, is it's somewhere in the middle, right? A lot depends on how you use it, on how the organization is deploying it, right? Like, there are worker-friendly ways to use technology for safety, certainly. But a lot of what we end up seeing, and this isn't shocking, right, is that managers deploy these tools or regulators deploy these tools in ways that actually fail to solve the real problems that exist in a workplace like trucking. And there are real problems, right, as you well know, related to safety, related to undercompensation of labor, related to the fact that truckers don't get paid for a good deal of their workday, right? Those problems are not touched by the technology. Instead, the technology is used to just police folks harder, but not to actually change the root causes of the problems in the industry, create safe places for them to sleep, et cetera, right? So you know, you end up in this kind of middle ground where the technology really changes what the work looks like. It doesn't necessarily take jobs away, right? It hasn't necessarily led to a shortage of jobs, right? Instead, what it has changed is the dignity of the jobs that people have, because they're joined in the truck cab by cameras that are in their faces, yep, and tools that are tracking all of their behaviors and their eyelids and, you know, to see if they're too tired to drive, all that kind of stuff. So it has really changed what it is to be a trucker.
No, you're absolutely right. And what it's done with these stricter hours and the stricter laws and all of this surveillance is what it's done is it's put the responsibility solely on the backs of the drivers. It's trickled down to it's that guy's fault, and it's not the companies. And the companies push people, especially in non-union sectors. Now, look, I've been fortunate my entire driving career. I've always held a union card. So if I'm tired, I'm pulling over and I'm taking time. If I can't do something, I'm not doing it. If a truck is unsafe to get on the road, it ain't happening. I'll give you a perfect example. Right when they came out with the 14-hour rule, I was 3 minutes from the terminal, 3 minutes. And as soon as the 14th, that minute to the 14th hour, I pulled over. I said, hey, come get me. I'm around the corner. And they're like, you're only 3 minutes away. I go, yeah, I'm only 3 minutes away. Come get me, because I'm not moving this truck after the 14th hour. That's how inflexible these rules are. And and you know this as well as anyone, had I been 1 minute after that 14th hour and some drunk ran into the back of me, I'm going to jail.
Yeah, you'd be in violation, right? And that kind of the flexibility and the autonomy that we demand of, you know, really critically essential workers, right? We like to talk a big game about essential workers, but we don't necessarily build the infrastructure that they need to get rest, right? Even if you're able to pull over, right, after 14 hours, the chances you're going to find a place to do that safely in many parts of the country, there's no place to do that safely. Yeah. So when we get mad about that too, right? You're not allowed to do that either. So, you know, we can talk a big game about it, but ultimately we don't give people the tools that they need to be successful. And a lot of people, you know, to your point, have relied upon the fact that the rules have been enforced, you know, in kind of a wigglier way, right? Like without digital enforcement. And because that was what truckers needed to do to get the job done and put food on the table and keep the lights on at home, was to break the law. Now, that wasn't a good situation either, right? Like that, I don't think the status quo is not a good situation. But again, instead of providing the infrastructure folks need, compensating people for the labor they actually do, our solution has just been to crack down on, as you pointed out, right, the least powerful people.
Yep. This is Karen, where I go, the reality is this is another example of trucking, of deregulation in the trucking industry and airlines, or you name what we've deregulated, and I'll show you an industry that workers have been screwed over in. When there were rules in place, when unions were strong, when I started in the LTL industry, the less than truckload industry, it was 85% unionized. And you had jobs that were family sustaining wage jobs, excellent health care benefits, excellent retirement security, good working conditions. You didn't have people running funny books and double books and doing all kinds of legal things, because you had a union who was saying, we're not going to let our people do this. And, you know, Reagan forward, and look, Jimmy Carter signed it, but Reagan really used it. And here we are in this moment where basically trucks are nothing but sweatshops on wheels, with people behind the wheel who are struggling to make ends meet and to meet the demands that are put on them. So more crackdown, more rules and regulations, that ain't helping. But here's the other thing, and you talk about this in the book. I think we're moving towards an era where, you know, in maybe 20 years, but there aren't going to be any more humans behind the wheel. They're going to be automated trucks. I think you could do it right now in a lot of instances. So I'm curious your thoughts. Is that going to be ultimately where we head? Because we got to make the road safer, Karen. You know how that goes. We got to protect the children. So screw those families, those drivers, and all of the industry. I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So you're right. I read about this in the book. I initially kind of maybe had the impression that, you know, maybe surveillance of workers and automation of workers are substitutes, right? You either have this heavily surveilled worker, heavily surveilled trucker, or that person just doesn't have a job because now we have automated trucks. What I think the reality looks like, though, in the medium term, like over the next few decades at least, is that the technology is good, right? But it's not good enough to replace truckers because, as you know, a truck driver does a hell of a lot more than driving a truck. There are lots of other components of the job. Even the technology that allows for self-driving trucks is not there yet. And it's, you know, it's some people don't know if it'll ever get there, right, where it can really replace a driver. So what AI looks like, right, what these new technologies look like in the truck cab now are not really replacing drivers, but surveilling them in these even more intimate ways. So sometimes that looks like, you know, a camera that's on the driver's face at all times. where AI is used to detect if the driver is too tired, right? Like they look for something like the driver's eyelids fluttering or head nodding, right? To see if they're too tired. And if they are, they'll sound an alarm and flash some lights in his face, right? And of course, tell the manager. Sometimes it looks like wearable devices, right? That detect a driver's brain waves or heart rate, right? So actually where I think AI is in the truck now is not so much replacing the driver, but actually surveilling them even more, right? Yeah. Like actually making them more of a cog in the machine.
No, and this is where I think they're attempting to make the industry so untenable, it's so annoying with buzzers and beepers and all kinds of things to keep you, you know, your eyes in other places, that people are going to leave the industry.
Yep.
People my age, look, if I had health insurance tomorrow, I'd give up driving tomorrow. And I know a lot of people who would do it as well, because you've taken the what brought you to the road away. You've now made this factory work. You've now made this. You're just in an office with somebody overseeing you. And I think that's part of the plan. This is where we may disagree. I think part of the plan is to make this job so untenable that eventually they have to go, hey, well, we can't find people. We got to go to automation.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting, I mean, I can see that for sure. And, you know, there's a deep irony in that, because in, you know, if you look at the regulations or you look at what companies say about why they deploy these technologies, like you said, it's all about safety, right? It's all about
always is
the public, and everybody wants safety, right? Like nobody wants unsafe roads. So that's like very easy to galvanize around that message. But as you pointed out, right, the folks that get driven out by these tools are the people you most want on the road, right? The people who've been on the roads for decades, who have millions of safe miles under their belts. And those are the guys that are going to leave, right? Because exactly what you said, right? Like they know what they're doing. They're experts. They know their bodies. They know the equipment. The folks who are less likely to leave are the 21-year-olds or the 18-year-olds who just got their CDL, right? Who don't resist in the same way because they never know any different. And what other job are they going to get that isn't like this, right? But those are not the drivers you most want to be next to on the highway.
No,
right?
And like their behinds are on fire. Look, they're only getting paid when the wheels are turning. If you really want to start dealing with issues in the trucking industry, let's look at some of the things that my grandparents' generation fought for. You know, giving drivers more flexibility to get there when they're safe to do so. You know, there used to be a day when truck drivers would pull over and help people on the side of the road that they didn't even know. They were the knights of the highway.
Exactly.
They were the enforcers of safe conditions because that's their workplace. And we've destroyed their ability to make a good wage. And we've said, oh, only when the wheels are turning. Mm-hmm. And we've basically starved them into this kind of situation. So I got to get the book in here. It's called Data Driven. I highly suggest this. We're going to get links out. Truckers, Technology, and the New Workplace Surveillance, written by Karen Levy. We'll get links out. You can also check out her website. Karen-Levy.net. We'll get stuff out to that. I highly suggest it. So, but here's the question I have. You know, people are going, wow, that's just the trucking industry. That's just those truck drivers. Who cares? You know, they'll be gone in the morning. Why does this matter to someone sitting in a cubicle? Why does this matter to someone working any other kind of job? Why is this important?
Yeah, I think, you know, anybody who has a manager, this stuff is coming for you too, right? There was a great story in the New York Times last year about productivity monitoring. And one of the people that they interviewed was a hospice chaplain. Like, can you think of a job that lends itself less to digital monitoring than being a hospice chaplain, right? Like talking to the families of bereaved people. But she wrote about, the reporter wrote about how she got, you know, 2 points for every phone call she made to like the daughter. I mean, it was just awful, right? But it's a good example of how the things that are happening to truckers, you know, are really happening across the board. They're happening in medicine, they're happening in education, they're happening to all kinds of different jobs because the technology is really cheap and because it's easier to deploy those tools than it is to actually solve the problems in a lot of these industries.
Right.
So I think workers, you know, anybody who has a job where they're managed, whether that's remote, right, like truckers were immune from some of this stuff for a while because they were on the road and we didn't have great ways to have oversight over
that's,
them.
That's what drove me to the industry.
Really?
You head out the gate and you are the captain of your ship. You'll get there when you get there. And I've said, you know, over 2 million miles myself, I've said, you know, I've never been late because the wheel, it's always here up on its wheels. You've had to come get me out of a ditch. I haven't hit anybody. You know, I'll get there when I get there. And, you know, I never gave excuses of what happened along the way. When I got to A to B, everything in between was me. Now you see these, what did you do for this 6 minutes? Where were you for this 8 minutes? That's not what drew me to the industry.
Yeah.
And again, I fear that this trickles down to the rest of the industry. Now, you point out that AI is cheap to deploy. And look, this is the reason why I think there's a push to replace truck drivers. and you know, automate this. And I think you could do this right now. I tell guys where I live here in central Pennsylvania, you could put a set on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, run it right through the Ohio Turnpike, right through the Indiana Turnpike, right to Chicago, and you wouldn't even have to fuel. It would just go on, like on a rail. If you get 7-10 of those in a row, you could lose a lot of jobs in that initial phase, which is why I think we need to, as legislators, as policy people, as voters, start talking about how are we going to negotiate this for the working class? Because every technological advancement comes with a class of workers taking it on the chin. And this is going to be the most disruptive, I think, in history. And I know they probably have said that in other times, but we have the ability to look back. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not saying we smash the machines, but we got to do something to prepare. Any suggestions?
Yeah, I mean, I am a little bit heartened. I don't know if you share this opinion, right? But I'm a little bit heartened by the fact that the Biden administration, especially the Office of Science and Technology Policy, does seem to be pretty seriously concerned about some of these issues. They have a request for information out that I think the comments are due tomorrow. They're interested in gathering stories from people who have been surveilled or where their jobs have been automated at work. And they're interested in deploying different regulations to try to protect folks in these positions. Some of it certainly is, you know, what do we do if people lose their jobs, right? Right. Retraining, stuff like that. But some of it is also making sure that the dignity of work is protected. So even for people who still have jobs, how do we make sure that their power is not, you know, or their bargaining power, their ability to negotiate wages, their ability to unionize? How do we ensure that these tools aren't deployed in such a way that it's unduly limiting that capability for workers?
Yeah, I got a whole bunch of ideas on this, especially when you're talking about truck drivers and low skill, low wage workers who are going to be affected by this. And I think there has to be a technology tax to make moving to these technologies much more expensive. Look, I'm not against it, but there's got to be a transition, and a just transition, so workers don't take it on the chin. And, you know, like I said, what are you going to train a 55-year-old truck driver to do to get him to the last 10 years before retirement? You're not going to train him to do anything that's going to make $100,000 a year like he's making, or 50 or 70 or whatever they're making now on the road. You're not going to get that. So there's got to be a way to make that person whole, to get them to retirement, and to help the next generation a little bit as we transition. So I think a technology tax is a huge part of this, and there's got to be a way to... And I'm not a universal basic income guy, but there's got to be something that attaches to other work that raises your wages to compensate. There's got to be a way forward. We're a smart species. If we can develop the thing that's going to destroy us, maybe we can figure out how to stop it and have it not destroy us. Thoughts?
I hope you're right.
I hope I'm right too. So last question I've got for you. What are you hoping to get out of this? What are you hoping folks take away from the book? And I hope folks will buy it. Data-driven truckers, technology, and the new workplace surveillance, written by Karen Levy. Karen-levy.net, the website. We'll get links out so you can take a look at that. What are you hoping people take away from this?
Honestly, I have been so humbled by the generosity that folks in trucking and in other low wage workplaces have shown me. The thing I most want to do is just be able to help share their stories, help share some of the generosity that's been given to me. I just want to pay that forward and make more people aware of, you know, what these essential workers do and the risk that they put themselves at every single day so that you can get your Amazon Prime packages.
Yeah.
Should all be, you know, we should not only be grateful and we should have a higher public opinion of these folks, but we also need to show it with policy, right? Like show it with fair wages and with infrastructure.
No, so absolutely. One of the things I love that you do in the book is you put a name and I imagine a face to that name and to that story, because it's easy to lump all these people into oh, those are just truck drivers, instead of, hey, that's Rick the truck driver. That's my neighbor. That's my brother. That's, you know, whatever. So I think by humanizing it, I think that's really important as well.
Well, thank you.
Good stuff. Again, the book Data Driven by Karen Levy. We'll get links out, karen-levy.net. Karen, thanks so much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks. It's been fun to join you.
Thanks so much. Again, the karen-levy.net. That's the website. I want you to take a look at that. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1924.
300 members of the International Workers of the World, or WOBLIs, gathered at their union hall in San Pedro, California. They were holding a benefit for two of their members who had been killed in a railway accident. For the past year, the KKK had targeted the San Pedro IWW members. The WOBLIs had led a strike of longshoremen the year before. Famous socialist author Upton Sinclair had visited San Pedro to address the striking members of the Marine Transport Workers. Known for his books such as The Jungle, Sinclair wrote novels depicting the harsh conditions of industrial work. To begin his speech, Sinclair planned to read the Bill of Rights. As he was reading the First Amendment, the one guaranteeing the right to free speech, he was arrested by police. The police and KKK members continued to harass the striking workers. Even after the strike ended, anger against the IWW simmered. That anger boiled over when KKK thugs stormed the benefit meeting, beating IWW members. They tarred and feathered some. They also flung scalding hot coffee at two children, who had to be hospitalized due to their injuries. A photographer who captured images of the injured children wrote a description of the events. Andrew Kruglis, age 9. Is in serious condition, he was the first one out of the hall. As the fiends came rushing in, Andrew ran as fast as he could for a block when overcome by a man in blue who threw a pot of boiling grease on his bare legs. In addition to the injuries caused, the raiders also destroyed the contents of the union's hall. The violence at San Pedro was just one chapter of ongoing harassment against IWW organizing up and down the West Coast. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any of the program, podcast, always available, always there for you. I want to finish up today with an email from Jack. He says, since 2010, Walker slash Republicans, he's talking about Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin at the time, this is their takeover and continued gerrymandering of our Wisconsin government, Republicans have continued to attack both secondary and university education here in Wisconsin. He says, in 2010, students could still go to the UW-Madison without huge debt if they had to borrow to get through, and many could, working a part-time during the school year and summers, pay for their entire education at what was one of the best universities, public or private, in the country. Now it costs about $25,000 per year to go to UW-Madison. With other non-related expenses, it is not improbable for a graduate of a so-called public university to leave with a debt of $50,000 or more. He says university education is no longer a realistic option for the majority of Wisconsinites thanks to repeated Republican defunding of that system. As Trump stated, Republicans love the poorly educated. And look, this is not just a Wisconsin thing. This is across the country. Where I'm at in Pennsylvania, it's the same thing. I said before, back in the 80s, you know, two-thirds were picked up by the tax base. A third was picked up by the student. Now it's completely on its head, where three-quarters of the cost of a public education, a public higher education, is now borne by the students. And look, I've got a relative who's $100,000 in debt going to public universities to become a veterinarian. And she's not going to make it. She's not going to become a veterinarian. She's taking this step down because she can't take out any more loans to get to be a veterinarian. It's mind-blowing. And then to hear the conditions, the terms of these loans, it should be angering to every parent. But Republicans are on the way. Tommy Tuberville, the dumbest guy in the Senate, he's going to help. And tomorrow on the program, we are going to get to the Republican plan in the Senate to save higher education. Republicans have got some, much like the Tax Cuts for Working Families Act, in the Senate, Republicans have some legislation going to help make things a little easier, make things a little bit better for college students to go to college. And if you believe that, I've got bridges. Because, again, I
I look at what they propose and what they put forth. Republicans hate working people. Just look at what they do. So I hope someone will try and prove me wrong. I love those emails. Please do. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Please. Because I want there to be, I want Republicans to come back to sane line. I want them to come back to saying, hey, how do we make people's lives better? Get me some decent Republicans, please.